From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As the 2016 presidential election in the United States draws to a close, we decided to summarize what's happened and take a look forward at what may happen with Professor Anthony Montero. First, I have to say, I heard a rousing speech that you gave in Philadelphia to wild applause yesterday. This is Sunday, the Green Party rally that featured Jill Stein, Ijeoma Baraka, yourself, Chris Hedges, and a number of others. Wow, I was really impressed.
It was an impressive event. It was my first Green Party rally since the big events that they had at the Democratic Party convention. And in spite of the fact that we have a transit strike, almost 250 people turned out, and they were activists, and they were really fired up. So it was a great event. Jill Stein and Ijeoma are impressive people. In fact, I compare favorably the Green Party, the Stein-Baraka ticket. I compare it favorably to Eugene Debs in 1912. I think it's going to have that type of impact going forward, and I think they could get upwards of 10 million, if not more, votes.
And as you pointed out, this is a critical moment in history. So when you're making that comparison, it's not just some sort of honorary acknowledgement, but this is an important moment.
Yes. And it takes a lot of courage to be Jill Stein at this time. And she is a very courageous and very brilliant woman.
So in terms of that, in terms of being courageous, maybe, you know, we're hours away now from Election Day and the beginning of the settling of all of this business that we've been talking about for the past year. And it's looking like a toss-up from everyone's perspective as to what the outcome is going to be. And then we know the elite is lined up on one side with all of the powers of the state and the courts and enforcement and media and everything. So what do you think we're about to see happen?
Well, it's difficult to predict, but you're right. The whole electoral map is in play, to use the language of the polling people. Everything is in play from Michigan and even Pennsylvania. Interestingly, of course, North Carolina and Florida. So it's anything could happen. Anything could happen, and everything depends upon turnout and who doesn't turn out. And that is why the Clinton campaign is going to spend its last day in this, what they hope to be a huge rally in Philadelphia with President Obama, First Lady Michelle Obama, Bill Clinton, and Hillary Clinton, and I guess a whole slew of entertainers like Bruce Springsteen and Bon Jovi and so on. They have to get the black vote out in Philadelphia. Black folk are not inspired either by Clinton or preserving the Obama legacy. They're just not. And so it will depend upon who turns out and what is the margin of victory, because the Clinton campaign will win Philadelphia, undoubtedly. But what will be the margin of victory that they take from Philadelphia, and how will that look in terms of what will happen in the rest of the state? I think the other big thing is Director Comey's letter yesterday, where he said that he's standing by his decision in July that there are no indictable or prosecutable offenses in the manner that Hillary Clinton handled her private server. This, to me, is far more than it seems to be. What we're looking at is an all-out war within the Justice Department and within the FBI. This is going forward. One of the huge outcomes of this 2016 election campaign and the crisis of legitimacy of all of the principal institutions of the American state, including now the legal and court system. And this is very important for a nation which portrays itself as a nation of laws and not of men, that no one is supposed to be above the law. People are now seeing that there are people, depending upon the class, the social economic class that you're in, who are indeed and have always been above the law. Now, this raises the flip question about the tens of millions of Black and Latino and poor white people and others, Native Americans, who have flooded the prison industrial complex over the last 25 years. The question becomes, if people like Clinton are above the law, are people like the poor victims of the criminal justice system below the law? Which then puts on the table, once again, is this a nation of laws, or has the whole thing been politically rigged from the very beginning?
You were speaking to that yesterday in a number of ways that I thought were I was very impressed with it as an intellectual argument and also as an argument for legal legitimacy, basically. We have, by some counts, 2 million people that are incarcerated. The Black and brown populations way overrepresented in that, and those who are not of those groups at the bottom of the privileged class of skin privilege, poor whites, people that don't have the money to hire lawyers or aren't protected by their social status from being charged in the first place, and all of that. Those people will remain in prison on the 9th and going forward in a climate where their imprisonment is suspect by the majority of the population, because the majority of the population, all of the people behind Trump, all of the people that were behind Sanders, all of the people on the streets, look at the legal system here as being an instrument of oppression, with a situation where the entire political and legal construct is being called into question on the streets, which seems like is going to be coming to us soon. What does that mean for the people behind the walls?
Well, and I'm always reminded first and foremost of the political prisoners. I'm reminded when I think about how the law functions politically, how the legal mechanisms, the courts, the investigators, the DAs, the prosecutors, the FBI, the CIA, how they all operate as a form of class justice. And therefore, I just can't help but be reminded of Julian Assange and the others who have been in prison because they're whistleblowers or those who leak secret inside information that expose the way the system actually works. And of course, the millions of people who are in prison now, who have been imprisoned and carry the mark of oppression from having been imprisoned, and therefore their lives are changed drastically. All of those thousands and tens of thousands who have been executed in prison through the death penalty over the years, those who have been committed or sentenced to slow death, that is life without parole. This vicious system, in some ways, that has the imprimatur of the Clintons all over it, and the great irony or contradiction that this name, which is synonymous with the modern prison industrial complex, is the very person who is above the law and gets a special type of justice. You know, Don, as I tried to point out when I spoke at the Green Party rally here in Philadelphia, I tried to point out that this is a period of growing class consciousness. You know, everyone will admit that Trump's voters and Trump's followers come disproportionately from the working, white working class and white poor people. But what is not recognized, in fact, what is diminished and obscured, is the fact that this moment is a period of the renaissance of a class consciousness. Now, that is not the same as a revolutionary consciousness, but it is a recognition of a we-they binary or situation between the poor and working class and the people represented by Wall Street, or the people who represent Wall Street and the 1%. This is a further iteration and evolution of the Occupy movement, which talked about the class division of the country. So we are in the renaissance of a class uprising, which is different from the Occupy movement, but in fact does build upon it.
Yeah, what we're talking about essentially is a crisis of legitimacy of the entire system, political, economic, social even, across the board and all of the institutions. And that happens in the wake of the development of this class consciousness. So although you may not have revolutionary consciousness at the moment, you have very deeply held class consciousness, very widely dispersed class consciousness, walking into what may be pre-revolutionary conditions.
Right, right. I think that's what we're looking at, and that's why the ruling class is throwing everything they can at this election and winning it by any means necessary, threats, intimidation, propaganda, the big lies that are being told, and on and on and on. And you know, I also tried to point out in the speech that, you know, because of the historic racial division of the working class, where white workers were privileged relative to black workers, because of that history, the coming together or the modes of the manifestation of class consciousness, and hence the coming together of workers across the color line and across the gender line, but in particular across the color line, will not be a single event. It will be a process, and hence it will be reflected in different ways by white workers and by black workers. And what I tried to say in that speech is that the fact that black folk are not coming out to vote, in particular the working class and poor, who were inspired by the idea of the first black president and hence came out in ways that they had never voted in any election, they are not voting. They are staying at home. All of the attempts of the Clinton campaign and the Obama White House and the corporate media to either shame them into voting or to get them out based upon fear are falling short. And I think it's in Philadelphia. I see it palpably here. I am certain it is in Detroit, Michigan, and Flint. And obviously from early voting data, this is the case in North Carolina and in Florida. Now, and they expected a large turnout, not at the levels of Obama's election and re-election, but a large turnout, and they expected that 95% of black people would vote for Clinton, for the Democrats. That is not a certainty. And I contend that the stay-home vote, the refusal to vote, which is a great refusal, is in fact another indication of class consciousness, and that the whole system is illegitimate, is crooked, and is broken, and they're not going to vote. And this has huge consequences for what the outcome of the election will be. Now, in Pennsylvania, and in Philadelphia in particular, we have a history of stealing elections. We have a corrupt political, governmental, electoral system here in Philadelphia. And there's no telling what they will do on election day. But nothing can alter what is happening among working people in this country and this growing and crystallizing class consciousness that will manifest increasingly as class upsurges. Just my last point. We have a transit workers' strike here in Philadelphia. I am certain that the leaders and members of the TWU, the Transport Workers Union here, have been set upon by the politicians and other labor leaders to get to the table and just accept whatever you can, or because you have to get the buses and subways and trolleys running before election day. There was even an attempt to force the workers back to work. None of that has worked. They're standing their ground. This is huge in my opinion. And growing parts of the Philadelphia working class are joining in solidarity with them. My last point, Don, and forgive me for talking so long, that I feel that what is happening both in the Trump movement among the working people voting for him and encouraging his candidacy, and among black people's refusal to vote is the beginning of a new moment in the history of the country. Things will never be the same. It's even questionable whether there will be a two-party system after this, and whether out of the organic experience of ordinary working people, a new party of working people, broadly understood, will emerge.
You know, when we were before we spoke on Friday, I think I mentioned to you that on my street in Westchester County, in Austin, New York, the other end of my street, there's two elected officials, one of whom is also a Democratic Party operative. He's a hardworking, ward healing kind of guy. You know, grew up in Brooklyn politics and such. And every year, the entire ticket is displayed on the lawns of all of the people that live around them, from the top of the ticket for president all the way down to the people running for village board. This year, none of them have any Hillary Clinton signs up. They only have the local races. I don't know if that reflects their personal animus towards Clinton or their recognition of the deep division inside the Democratic Party voters on the issue of Hillary Clinton, and their concern that they could lose support by expressing, among Democratic voters by expressing support for Clinton. That, in either case, is problematic for the get-out-the-vote effort that the party is mandating for those folks. And I'm wondering if that kind of phenomenon is widespread across the country and if it's going to be manifest in, a lower turnout, basically.
Yeah, I think those stories and those experiences begin to suggest something about what is going on. Here you have Democratic Party operatives who are refusing to go along with the party line, especially as it relates to Clinton. I think that the pressure of the Sanders and Trump insurgencies has caused divisions that already existed within government institutions like the Justice Department and like the FBI to come out in this dramatic way. And the FBI is still divided. And we might get some leaks from the FBI today, rogue elements as they're called. The continuing leaking of insiders, what they call whistleblowers, of inside information about how the government works. And I think you're going to find more of this and more people prepared to go to jail to get the truth out. Chelsea Manning is a heroic example of this, as is Assange and Edward Snowden. But there are hundreds of them throughout the government, what you might call people's sleeper cells. Mm-hmm. So I think the whole system is in breakdown mode. As we talked last week, the stock markets, especially the S&P index, which really measures what is going on with the bond markets, has had the longest bearish or a non-growth or decline in prices in this period, the longest stretch of that in 36 years. And the markets are jittery all over the world. You read the financial press and they acknowledge that. And even after the election, because they see what is going on here as an equivalent of Brexit, the British people voting to leave the European Union. These are rebellions. And if they become generalized throughout the advanced capitalist countries in particular, they carry significant weight for the future of capitalism, how it will function, and in particular for the United States people, the future of this American military economic empire.
You know, I have a few thousand Facebook friends that are outside the United States. And there's been a conversation going on among many of them for weeks now that essentially boils down to this, that the U.S. media hasn't been doing news coverage for months, really, of important events. Like today, I saw go by very quickly, which is actually troubling in the current context, claims that Russian jets are buzzing Estonian airspace. They're referring to it as NATO airspace, with all of the implications that that carries in the event that Clinton either wins or is declared the winner in any event for the policy of the U.S. and NATO going forward. But they're saying that what's happened, rather than news, you have a bunch of talking heads that are sitting around issuing their opinions about the election and the candidates, and in the place of the news. That, of course, is a heavy thumb on the scale of the outcome, which has been witnessed by the majority of people in this country and noticed by a majority of them, I believe, at least anecdotally, heavily anecdotally. Even if Clinton wins, an honest vote, if that could be proven, her election is not going to be recognized, certainly by the 47% that the elite acknowledges are behind Trump. And maybe half of the people that voted for her who actually are doing it out of fear of Trump. That means, of course, that there may well be some sort of unrest, perhaps even some style of uprising that takes place inside the country in rebellion against this last gasp of the elite. What should people be thinking and doing to position themselves for this particular battle? Or alternatively, if Trump wins and then turns around and starts talking more of the same in opposition to what he's been promising, what do people? How do people defend themselves and start putting our agenda out and finding a common agenda?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, we can't forget that what is driving both the Sanders people and the Trump people is the economy. This is kind of what you call delayed blowback from the 2007-2009 Great Recession.
Agreed.
And the fact that the banksters were bailed out and people were left to their own devices, which meant increasing poverty, unemployment, the loss of homes, and inability to pay off college loans and all of that. So the economy is the issue. And the economy that people experience, that the working class and the lower middle classes and young people experience, is not the economy that is talked about in the corporate media or by the politicians. So the economy shows no signs of improving. We're in a period of a long stagnation now, which came in the wake of the, and I put quotes, recovery from the Great Recession. So we're in a long period of stagnation. Long periods of stagnation like this that are accompanied by stock market bubbles, which burst at any time. So you get a bubble on the stock market that could burst side by side with a long stagnation, both under 2%. This could lead to what some call another epic recession, a great recession, which would only give fuel to the fire of class consciousness and class rebellion, which will produce new levels of class unity. It is very apparent that the pro-democratic party labor bureaucrats will face a rank and file and are facing a rank and file rebellion. You talked about your Democratic Party officials in your county. What do you think it feels like to be leading a local of the United States Steelworkers in Cleveland, Ohio, or Lorain, Ohio, where you're saying, get out the vote for Hillary, and over half your membership is saying, hell no, we're going with Trump, or we're going with Jill Stein, or we're going not to vote. That is a rank-and-file rebellion. The same thing here in Philadelphia with the black working class. Most of our major unions, our largest unions in Philadelphia, are led by African-Americans. However, the greatest concern for the political machine is that black folk are not going to come out to vote. Now, who are these black folks? They are the working class. They're members of unions. Ask me, the teachers union, the transport workers union, and others, and they are rebelling against the positions of their leadership, which means that we're in a crisis of the labor movement and a crisis of leadership, a crisis of the legitimacy of leaders who put the Democratic Party and its rich billionaire candidates ahead of the interests of working people.
Well, we're going to have to talk about this on Wednesday after the vote numbers start coming in and the media starts presenting us with who they believe is going to be our next president. And thank you so much for all of the time you've given us over the course of this campaign. And we'll be talking about what's next as soon as we get there. Professor Montero, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.